Very good. So, welcome to seventh morning, Thursday, seventh. Is that right? Close enough, anyway. So, for today's talk and morning talks, to go a bit deeper into the meditation, and one of the reasons, again, that sometimes people come here just to try and improve themselves or try and get some peace from their busy lives or try to get some cure from some sicknesses and stuff. But there's more to, obviously, meditation than that. This is a Buddhist meditation path. And so as such, you know, that sometimes you have to understand where this all fits in together with the reason why the Buddha taught. And of course, you know, the main teaching of the Buddha was the Four Noble Truths. And I mentioned earlier that the first talk, I think, in the evening, there were two types of meditation: Second Noble Truth Meditation and Third Noble Truth Meditation. And that's Second and Third Noble Truths are really important. That's basic stuff. But for that Second Noble Truth, you know, you all know what it means, that Tanha is the cause of suffering. And that Tanha, sometimes it's translated as craving, but it's much more subtle than that, because it's pretty easy to let go of, you know, craving for most things, but there's still, you have wants and desires in life, and they cause you a lot of suffering. And you can see that in your meditation practice. When you want things to be different, when you want to get somewhere, when you want to get rid of something, that by itself is suffering. Just as the Buddha explained it, you know, if one looks at these teachings and one really focuses on them and one just allows those teachings to actually do their job, not to think about them, but to allow them to, like, once they've been sowed into the mind, to germinate and to throw forth their shoots, and eventually, you know, they give their fruit, all those teachings. And little things like what the Buddha said about the explanation of suffering, that being separated from what you want or being associated with what you don't want is called suffering. In other words, here I am, tired, restless, and I don't want to be like that. I want to be in bliss, in jhanas, in light, and that's where I want to be. Now you understand what suffering is. Wanting to be someplace you're not. Or you are here, and you really need to go back to bed. But you can't. So you are separate, you are associated with what you don't want. So all of these things, it shows this is not just craving, this is just basic wanting. Wanting to be somewhere else. And I mentioned this because yesterday I was talking about the simile of being in prison or being free. And it has nothing to do with your situation. Nothing to do whether you are aching, in pain, whether you are just so relaxed. It's really, do you want to be here or do you want to be somewhere else? And if you want to be somewhere else, that's called desire. That is suffering, right there. It's not the situation you're in is suffering. It's wanting to be somewhere else is suffering. But when you understand that, you can understand why the Second Noble Truth meditation is always wanting to be somewhere else. And you think, but, all the old buts. Well, we're supposed to get nimittas, we're supposed to be free, we're supposed to be happy, we're supposed to. Straight away, where are you now? Do you want to be somewhere else? That is called suffering. So, what do we do? We don't do Second Noble Truth Meditation, we do Third Noble Truth Meditation. Letting go of wanting is the cause for enlightenment, for nibbana. Letting go of wanting. Hard thing to do. Because, as the old saying goes, you tell yourself, come on, let go. Let go. I told me, let go. Let go. as your mom. Come on, let go. And of course, that is just more wanting. It's not letting go at all. Which is one of the reasons why in that third noble truth that's taught by the Buddha, I gave a whole talk on this once, I think, in Nolamara, and it became the most popular talk downloaded online, The Four Ways of Letting Go. It was really amazing that no one's seen that before, and just basic stuff. You know the four ways of letting go? One is called chaga, giving. It doesn't mean putting donations in the box, although that also counts as well. It just means giving up of all your views and ideas and just being free and giving up all of the anger and the grief and the remorse from the past, letting it go for goodness sake. Giving up your fears of the future. But it's also a type of giving, which I often see in this, that sometimes you go to temples and you see that these big signs, this is Dhirayupa Hall, because that person sponsored it. Or you see, this is Ananda Meditation Center. And that is not generosity. To me, that is buying advertising rights for your ego. You understand that? Did you see, this hall was donated by the Gotama family or whatever. Now, there's something wrong with that. Because what that is just, again, it's not real giving. It's getting something back in return. And it's like sometimes people, they give a lot to this place and they don't expect anything back. You know, some of those best donors are the invisible ones. People you just don't know. And there's all these wonderful little inspirational stories about giving. You know, the Dharmasara Nuns Monastery. One of the stories there. You know, the trying to get a place for women, for nuns, and so there can be, you know, some fairness here. Still work in progress, but that's life, is work in progress. But when we started this, of course, the first thing you did is put an article in a newsletter, anyone interested, get a fund started, a bank account, and it wasn't getting anywhere. I think it was maybe $2,000, $3,000, $4,000 in there, but you can't buy a nun's monastery for $4,000. Well, not in this place anyway. But maybe in Syria, or land is going cheap there. But so what happened next? At least the word was out there. Then what happened next was this gentleman, many of you have heard this story, but I love telling because it's so, to me it's very inspiring because I actually saw it and was there. This gentleman came to Bodhinyana Monastery over the road in front of the kitchen. He just came out of a car and he had, what was it, just thongs and shorts and singlet, not an expensive car, just an ordinary car. And, you know, a Caucasian, and he told me, he said, I'd like to make a donation to your nuns' monastery. Said, okay, well, you know, donation box upstairs. No, no, no. He said, I want this because my wife has just been given birth to my first child, a daughter. He said, I'm a Buddhist, he said. Never seen him before. And he said that I don't know if my daughter would ever want to be a nun, but I want her to have the chance, the opportunity. You know, maybe 18, 20 years in time, maybe, if she wants to, I want it there for her as a choice. So it's open. So can I give the donation? He said, yeah. So, and he gave me a check, $250,000. Never seen him before. He left and never seen him again. Weird. I don't even know what his name is, honestly. He must have something in the record somewhere in the treasury or something. But I don't know him. He never left his name. That's like chaga. That's giving, expecting nothing back in return. You know, you'd love to actually find out where he was and invite him to come and see what's happened to his donation. But that is not the amount, but just the fact not asking anything back at all, just the joy, just to give, to let go, to offer. That is letting go of possessions, letting go of your attachments, letting go for, but you don't get something back at all. I thought it was very beautiful. That type of stuff is chaga. That is the sort of stuff that all the people who look after this place, look after Nolamao, a lot of them you don't know. They just give and disappear afterwards. Make no fuss and bother. Just thank you for the opportunity to give, that's all. That is a type of letting go which is actually beautiful. That is third noble truth type of letting go. Giving up. Somebody makes a noise, always boiling a pot of hot water at 2 o'clock in the morning, every evening. Not only that, but when they stir up their coffee. And then, oh, they're finally finished. And they start again. Come on. So, what do? You just give, just let go. Bit of kindness, compassion. Oh, the poor things, they must be thirsty. You know, they must be having a wonderful cup of coffee. Oh, I'm so delighted that they're enjoying themselves. You can do things like that, or you can just complain. One is letting go, the other one is just asking for suffering. So that's how we give. The other type of letting, three types of letting go, the other one is called throwing things away, pati nisaga. All the stuff which you don't need, throw it out. To me, that was the simile of a hot air balloon. And a hot air balloon, to go really, really high, you have to throw out as much as the ballast, all that weight you have in the basket, and go really high. But then you're up there high, and you know, still got some further place to go. So what else can you give up? So you look in there, you've got your sandwiches, you've got your thermos of tea, throw it out. And then everything you've got there is just thrown out. There's your shoe, the basket, and the balloon. And so how can I go higher? And then you say, well, there's nothing else to throw out. Of course there is. The basket. They throw the basket out. And then you're just holding on to the balloon with your hands. And then you can't go any higher. And you say, no, it's still not Nibbana yet, so what do I do now? So you throw you off. Your sense of self and ego. Then the balloon goes into Nibbana. That is my simile of letting go of everything. Of course, you know, the cup of tea and the sandwiches, that's all your cravings, your physical cravings. Throw those out. And you've just got the basket, you and the balloon. The basket is called the body, the basket case. Especially if you get to my age and your age. They throw that off. So it's just your mind and the balloon. And then the last bit, you have to let you go. Throw yourself off. So there's nothing left. Ego is totally gone. That's called pati nisaga, throwing away. And of course, the mutti, freedom, that's the simile of the wanting to be here. It's crazy, isn't it, that to be free, we feel that we really do need actually to have a nice environment to be free. We can't get that. Even as a monk. I thought when I first ordained, I will find a nice little cave somewhere and just relax and be peaceful and not bothered at all. But it doesn't work out that way. The more you try and renounce, the more people follow you. So it started off in, again, when I was wandering around on my charika over in Thailand, northeast Thailand. I went to the north of Thailand, it's much cooler over there. And I found another nice monastery, not the monastery where I spent the rains. This was in Ampaphang. That's one of the nice provinces there. And again, it was a lovely little monastery. with lots of limestone caves, and of course you'd explore them all. But then it came to Vaisak Day. Vaisak ceremony to remember the Buddha's birth, birth, enlightenment, and passing away. And so lots of people came to that monastery. And of course I was the only Western monk there. Western monks were really quite rare in those places, especially ones who could speak Thai. And so that I was very happy because there was a monk there, he was the abbot, the senior, so he gave the talk on Vaisak Day. And so after the talk, you know, that I could sort of go away a little bit. But then all the people decided they weren't really interested in the abbot's talk, they followed me. And I didn't mind just sitting down and just discussing Dhamma, but was it Dhamma or meditation they were interested in? Not at all. They said, "Where are you from? What does your mother and father do? How many brothers and sisters have you got?" And they'd answer those, and then they'd go away, and another group would ask the same. And after about an hour of that, the same question, where are you from? What does your mother and father do? How many brothers and sisters have you got? Then I decided that I had enough of that. I got bored, waste of time. I wanted to meditate. Now, in that monastery, there were these great limestone caves, and I knew them all, so I explored them all. So I got I said I was going to the toilet. I was going to the toilet, but you know, it was an excuse to not come back again. So I got some water, a flashlight, and a nice little my cloth, and I went into the deepest of the caves, right to the very end, so I could escape and meditate. I thought, you know, I'd be safe in the deepest cave. I went into the deepest cave, sat at the end, a really nice meditation, until I heard the sound of some people. And they were getting louder and louder and louder and louder. And I could see just, you know, these caves, these chambers, they turn this way and that way. See, the end of the cave where I was sitting at the very end, there was, you know, the wall. I could see the light get lighter and lighter. Oh, people were coming. And I saw this light, and somebody, the leader of this group of Thai people, they turned a corner, and immediately they looked at me, and they went straight back again. And I was just sitting there, very peaceful. And I heard them talking. There's a ghost at the end of the tunnel. It's a ghost. That's what I said. I said, yeah, yeah, believe it. There's a ghost. And they said, no, it can't be a ghost. I've never seen a ghost at the end of the tunnel before. Yeah, there is. There is. And so then two heads poked around. They went back quickly. It's not a ghost. It's a Western monk. No, it's a ghost. It's a Western monk. I said, please vote for ghost. But then they looked around a third time. So, it's a Western monk. I was so disappointed. So they all came in. There's no way to escape. The end of a tunnel. So they all came in and they sat down and said, what country are you from? What did your mother and father do? How many brothers and sisters have you got? And I realized there's no escape. So that's the trouble, isn't it? That when you try and leave the world follows you. The more a person becomes unworldly, the more disciples you have and the more things they give you. Crazy, isn't it? So I realized in this world that, yeah, what is a renunciant monk? It has to be someone who just sits here and lets people come up and say, what country are you from? What's your mother and father do? How many brothers and sisters have you got? And renowned enough to have kindness to answer them with politeness. That's called letting go. You know, later on in my life, it got far, far worse than that. You know, going to Indonesia, of all the places I go to, that's where I have to sign the most books. It's absolutely ridiculous. Because giving a talk, but then afterwards, You have a whole line of people. You've seen that conga. It's this huge line, an hour or two. Sign a book, have photograph, sign a book, photograph. That was actually some of the first Bahasa words I learned. Eka dua tika. Yeah, satu dua tika, yeah. Satu dua, one, two, three. But it happened once. It wasn't actually in Jakarta, it was some other place. Oh, I was just waiting. I needed to go to the toilet. And this is a whole line of people. And sign a book, photograph, sign a book, photograph, sign a book, photograph. And I thought, what am I doing this for? And I thought, I never became a monk to do this. I became a monk just to be peaceful and calm and just go into solitude. But then I thought, hang on, Ajahn Brahm, don't you remember that talk I gave about letting go? About suffering is not wanting to be here. Wanting to be somewhere else. Wanting to be in my cave. Not in front of loads and loads of people signing books and having my photograph. And I don't know why people want to take a photograph of me. You know, I'm not like Taylor Swift or Arnie Schwarzenegger. Or I don't know who else you'd like. I don't know. But why do you want to take a photograph of a fat old monk? I don't know. But anyway, if that's what you want, well, it's wonderful. You know what we tried? We tried printing the books with already pre-signed. So already signed, a signature on there. So then no, they wanted a real one. So that didn't work. So we decided to try thumbprints. So thumbprints. So they all lined up for their thumbprints. They went around again for the real signature. There's no escape. Oh, the time when, what was it? I was coming back from United States, and on Singapore Islands, a lot of people actually work inside the terminals. So as soon as I arrived, they were at the gate. I said, oh, Ajahn Brahm, please come and have something to eat, or a cup of tea or something. There's no escape. So I went in there, it was about an hour before the connecting flight back to Perth. And in there, and just, they were asking me questions. Oh, I was tired, I wanted some downtime, some free time. Oh, what Donald Trump says, executive time. But I don't use any tweets. But anyway, executive. So anyway, I was there just asking questions. And I just, okay, I needed a break. So I used the old restroom excuse. I said, I need to go to the restroom. And I was going to spend about 10 minutes in there, just sitting on there. I didn't need to do a number two. I just wanted to sit there and rest, have a bit of meditate. But you know what happened? As soon as I went into the toilet in the Changi Airport, I forget which terminal it was, as soon as I went into the restroom, the male's restroom, the toilet attendant looked at me and said, oh, you Ajahn Brahm, I really need to answer questions on meditation. Oh, no, come on. Not in the male toilets. There's no escape. But you know what happened? That was such a wonderful thing because, you know, the old fellow, you know, he really appreciated the answers and he said, I want to make a donation. So he got about, you know, 10 Singapore dollars out. And of course, as a Buddhist monk, you can't receive any money. So I said, look, I can't receive it. He said, oh, but I just want to help out. And it's not exactly a well-paying job, being a toilet attendant. But nevertheless, he wanted to make a donation. So you know what I did? Just on the hand towel, I just wrote the address of Bodhinyana Monastery. And then afterwards, I was just, you know, so amazed and so overjoyed. You know, he sent that in an envelope and posted it to us. I thought, that's just what a great donation that was. That's up there with $250,000 donation. Poor fellow, you know, just, you know, wanted to show some gratitude. And he went to such extreme lengths for actually to send it to me. But the point is, complaining. Oh, it shouldn't be like this. Why me? I've been meditating here a long time. This is the only time I get to meditate, and my mind is all over the place. It's not fair. I need to have a few more days. And then you realize that is not meditation at all. It's missing the point. It's all about learning how to let go. Third noble truth. So, I don't judge my meditation by, okay, oh, beautiful light, oh, yeah, this is nice, or, just as long as I'm happy to be here. I let it be. I don't want to be anywhere else except just here. When I just want to be here, then you feel free. Even the Buddha would have aches and pains, would have stomach aches, would be tired, old age, body falling apart, monks misbehaving, whatever it was, the Buddha would just sit there and be able just to realize this is our world. So, time, you can just let it go. Not want anything else in the whole world just except to be here. Not wanting, craving, going. And then, the strange thing which I've been trying to impress, that when you do not want anything, when you sit still, that's when things happen. Weird, isn't it? You don't make them happen. You sit still, and that's when they happen. So, one of Ajahn Chah's most amazing stories. There's a couple I'm going to say this morning, the deep ones. When he first said this, I just went to Wat Pa Pong. This is 43 years old. He never repeated this story. You know, he would tell the stories, you know, over and over for about a couple of weeks or a month, and then it would fall off his repertoire and new ones would come in. And so that was the story. But at the time, I you know, only just a young monk. I didn't know what I was doing. It made no sense to me, as it makes no sense to many people. But the point was that I remembered it somehow, subconsciously, because I didn't try to remember it. And it was so amazing, similarly. It was the one about sitting under the mango trees. Because he said that his monastery, Wat Pa Pong, was a mango orchard with the mango trees planted by the Buddha himself. And I thought, this is weird. The Buddha never came to Thailand. And people would like to think that they went to this country and that country. But you know, it's pretty clear the Buddha stayed in the Ganges Valley in India. People say, no, Ajahn. But anyway, we won't go there. But saying that he went to northeast Thailand, I don't think was credible. Certainly wouldn't be planting mango trees. So it was a simile. So where's this going, I thought. And then he said, today the mango trees are ripe, full of juicy, ripe, sweet mangoes. Thousands of them. And he said, but you try and shake that tree to get the mango to fall, and it'll never fall. You try and climb the tree, you never get up there. You try and throw something at the tree, a stick, try and get the mango to fall, it'll never fall. And of course, you know, being a Westerner, I said, well, have you tried like cherry pickers? You know, there's different, or really tall ladders. Even a helicopter to get those mangoes. But he said, whatever you try, you won't get a mango that way. There is only one way to get the mangoes from the trees planted by the Buddha. And that is to sit perfectly still underneath the mango tree. Still, perfectly still. And hold out your hand. And a mango will fall. And that was the end of the simile. And of course, I thought that was pure, unadulterated go, my young. So I dismissed it. The way the mind works is so strange. Things like that which come from a great teacher, it just goes in, gets in storage. I don't know where that got stored, but it was there, because later on when things started to happen in your meditation, your practice, that came up, and wow, how accurate that was. That's the way it works. sit perfectly still, opening up your hand, opening up your heart, kindness, to let these mangoes come to you. Face them, and they'll run away. You get frustrated. Sit perfectly still, open up your heart, your mind, and all these incredible insights, incredible states of meditation, they just come to you. Goes totally against the grain of how I was brought up. Struggle, strive, you get somewhere, well done, you get your medal, well done, you get another medal. People feel, oh, you deserve that because you work for it. Getting something for nothing didn't seem to be the right way to go about things until you realize how much work it is to do nothing. How difficult a task it is just to sit still and do absolutely nothing. But that's what happens. And after you understand this, you look back at what the Buddha said, and absolutely true. You just let go of wanting. And that is where the art of disappearing happens. And the art of disappearing, it was a simile that I was adventurous when I was a young man. So I did try other traditions. And I did go to the Zen monastery in the north of England, where you'd sit facing a white wall, and if you nodded, you get hit on the back with a Zen stick. But I always had very, very good karma. I was a very lucky man because I never got hit. The guy sitting next to me got hit, and that was enough for me. That cured my sloth and torpor for the rest of the weekend. I didn't want to get hit like that. So I was meditating out of fear. I was just... No, because I was sleepy as well, but the point was the guy sitting next to me was more sleepy than I was. So when he got first, I was bottled up. But that wasn't the point of the retreat. The point of the retreat was weird. I had to sit with my eyes open. Now, many people say, should you keep your eyes open or your eyes closed during a meditation? It's much better to keep your eyes closed. But in that tradition, just following the instructions, I just kept my eyes open and facing this whitewashed wall. The point was I'd already done enough meditation to know how to be in the present moment and how to stop thinking. Because most people, if you're watching a whitewashed wall, after you start fantasizing and dreaming and planning what you're going to do next. But I was just watching that whitewashed wall, just absolutely in the present moment, just not thinking. Just maybe because the training you had as a scientist, you just collect the data. You don't analyze it until all the data's in. So you sit there, keep to see what happens, and we'll figure out the meaning out afterwards. So there I was watching this whitewashed wall, and then after a few minutes, the wall vanished. It disappeared. And that was the weirdest thing. It wasn't that I saw blackness, it's just there's no wall there, nothing there. And what you're supposed to, when that happens to you, what am I supposed to watch? Don't interfere with this incredible experience. Walls are vanishing. Now they're there, now they're not. That was strange. But the wall came back again later on. And then I started to contemplate, once the data was in, what was going on? And after a little while, it was quite obvious that the sense of sight, like all your other senses, a whole six of them, including the mind, only notices things which change. If whatever you're aware of does not change, if it is still, then it will soon disappear. White wall, just watching that, focus on that, not on the thoughts, just the sight, and then it vanished. And I realized, hey, I should have known that, because when I close my eyes, when I first close my eyes, I'm aware of the inside of my eyelids. That's what I'm seeing now. If I focus on that and not what I'm saying, that after a little while, the eyelids, you wouldn't see them anymore. They would disappear. Sense of sight will turn off. And of course, these days, we recognize that's the same way computers work. You don't click the mouse, and after a while the screen goes into its screensaver, and after a little while longer it turns off. That's what happens with those senses. Sight just stops. The body, after a while, vanishes, stops. There's nothing going on there. That's why it's so important to be comfortable when you start meditating. When you're comfortable, there isn't so many distractions, an ache here, a pain there. It's like with a sense of sound. There's nobody just clanging the teacup, making their tea, or just banging the doors. If it's an ambient means a constant background sound, you don't hear anything. That's why you can be in a room with an aircon, and after a while, when you first, is the aircon on now? No, it's not. Even if it was on, you would notice it after a while, simply because it's a constant hum in the background. So after a while, if it is a constant hum, it vanishes and disappears. This is how the senses turn off one after the other. Stillness leads to disappearance. To anicca. Anicca! Look, this, I know that unfortunately there's some people who try and get an edge in their teachings. In other words, the only way to get sort of traction is to be the person who finally discovers the real meaning, the secret teachings, which everyone else has missed. So there are some people apparently going around, you know, actually saying anicca. No, it's not the usual spelling, but it's A-N-I-C-C-H-A. No desire or no wanting. Nice try, venerable monks, but it doesn't work. Anicca does mean once it was there, now it can go. Nothing to do with wanting. More to do about uncertain, changeable. And it doesn't mean just rise and fall. If you look at the lake, you can see the waves go up, the waves go down. Yeah, that's ordinary stuff. But to be able to watch a lake and see it vanish, see it totally disappear, that is anicca. Where this comes from is the word Nietzsche. One of the great things when you actually learn some Pali, you actually read it for yourself. Start with the Vinaya, the monks and nuns' rules. I say that because it's not about rules, it's the stories where those rules came from. Real life anecdotes of, you know, life 2,500, 2,600 years ago. And there you see words like Nietzsche, where, you know, these words are used in everyday life. And Nietzsche was something which was regular. A regular supply of food. Like there's some people come and feed the monks and the nuns sort of, you know, once a week, every Tuesday, every Wednesday, even Thursday today. So I know at Bodhinyana, you know, the sort of people who often come on a Thursday if they're not on retreat, like David and Lee usually come on Thursdays because he's on retreat now. So, you know, they come on, that's their day, once a week. We call that Nietzsche, regular supply of food. And anicca, when what was regular, what was always there, dependable, no longer there. The wall vanishing. That was a wonderful example of what anicca really is. Things which aren't supposed to vanish. They do vanish. And that sometimes is very scary for people. That is one of the reasons why it's difficult to meditate for some people, because what really is stopping you, you go into places you've never been before. Because of unfamiliarity, you get a little bit scared. See? Lack of comfort, not in the comfort zone. So little by little, you sit there and your body vanishes. And you know, my job is to encourage you to allow that to happen. You're perfectly safe. So it means that even sometimes that people would actually come to me and say, Ajahn Brahm, I need to speak to you now. Why? What's happened? Says, oh, weird. What happened? Oh, my hands vanished. Oh, come on. There's lots more to vanish yet. So, you know, you get lost, vanish. But for people who are always aware of their body, actually to see that your awareness is strong, but the body's starting to vanish. You can't feel your legs, you can't feel your back, your hand, your head. You know, that's quite scary for some people at first. Because when you can't feel it, you think you're in danger, you're out of control. And then what happens is you can't feel your breath. Ah! This is what's supposed to happen. The five senses are supposed to disappear. So don't think, but this is supposed to be breath meditation. It's not breath meditation. It is breath meditation is just part of the path. It's not the whole path. It's that story of using different vehicles. Ajatasattu to get to see the Buddha, using different vehicles to get into Jhana Grove. You cannot bring your boots into Jhana Grove. If you came in a car, you can't park your car inside here. If you came in an aircraft, especially, you can't land your aircraft, you know, just here. Different vehicles for different parts of the path. Breath has done its job. Now it vanishes. And for some people, that is weird. But it's very peaceful, very joyful. You don't have a body to worry about. As I mentioned, having typhus fever, having that body vanish, being eaten by mosquitoes, couldn't feel the mosquitoes anymore because the body just disappeared. That was so much bliss. The insight which you get from that should be pretty obvious. That this body is suffering. It's not the way you look at it, it's not just that you know you're not healthy enough, or you should exercise more, or you should get a life, Ajahn Brahm. No, this body inherently is a pain, even when it's healthy. Because when it disappears, that's the far best, because a whole heap of suffering has been let go of for a little while. Now, of course, I come to one of those stories. There was this lady who, BBC documentary, who had an out-of-the-body experience. She was having an operation somewhere in the National Health Service in UK, and she claimed that she left her body, and at that time the doctor said, you know, she'd actually died, but, you know, she revived later on. And this is the story she told. She said this was not the first operation. She called herself a piece of work because the doctors had given her so many operations to try and heal this and heal that. Her body was a bit of a wreck. If it was a car, it would be sent to the scrapyard and cash in on the insurance, but because we can't do that, you know, we can't sort of have euthanasia, we can do that to cars, but not to human beings, that's another subject. But here, that she was just so fed up with her body that when she left her body, it was so much peace and happiness. And as she was being interviewed by the BBC, you could see her smile as she was recording this wonderful time. Just out of her body, no pain, no heaviness, floating around. But that's actually when she came up to this, no, she didn't describe it, some spirit, some male guy, who said to her, Madam, you have to go back. It's not your time to die. And she said, I don't care, I am not going back. But you have to. No way. But you must. I'm not going back to that bomb, that terrible dustbin of a body. But you have to. No. So she was describing, you know, because when you describe these things, all the facial features come out. And she was arguing with the spirit on the spirit plane. She was not going to move. She wasn't going to go back. He can't tell me what to do. And having had this big argument on the psychic spirit plane, or the astral plane, or whatever it was, then it was resolved. The only way he could resolve it, somehow or other, this spirit got hold of her and threw her back into her body. Violently. And that point, on the interview, she really screwed her face up. Now, she was really angry, really upset. And she said, when I really die next time, the first thing I'm going to do is find that guy, and you wouldn't believe what I'm going to do to that guy. She was so angry. She really wanted revenge, big time. It was an amusing video, love documentary by the BBC, but the point which I got out of that is that, you know, she knew just being free of this body is being free of a whole mass of suffering. Not the whole mass yet, but a lot of it. And the point is that now, through experience, you can have some idea of what this the Lord Buddha was talking about. He talked about suffering. But it doesn't go much further than that. Because that's only five of the senses. What about the mind? Now when that starts to disappear, that's really cool. The sixth sense. Buddha said that many, many times, that's suffering as well. The mind disappearing, what does that actually mean? As the body vanishes, you get these beautiful nimittas, that's you on the edge of entering the world of the mind. But beautiful, it's so delightful. Why? Again, it's because the more delightful those nimittas are, the brighter they are, the more stable they are, the further you are away from your body. Sometimes you can still just about feel the body, but as those nimittas go stronger and as you really absorb into them, then your body vanishes. Oh, what bliss. That's precisely how the Buddha described it. It's vivekaja, piti sukha, the bliss from being secluded, apart, renounced from the five senses. That is where we are. In the first jhana. One of the reasons why, if people say, oh yeah, I was in the first jhana, but I could hear the bells, that's not the first jhana, not the jhana at all yet. The five senses have to disappear. And the insight which arises from that afterwards is that now you actually have some idea of the predicament you are in, having a body. It is suffering. What do I mean by that? The simile which I found the most effective, and I said I'll do two of the big similes today. The first one was all the mango orchard. The second simile was the tadpole and the frog. Tadpole, because saying a simile, you can get some more understanding of the meaning of this. A tadpole born in water, lived all her life in water. How can she ever understand the nature of water? No more than a fish can. Human being, born in the body, lived all its life in the body. You may even go and do a medical degree and become a professor of anatomy. I remember just talking to one of these people who did the autopsies here in Perth. You see the autopsies, how do you feel about, you know, your own body or your wife's body? And she said, well, I compartmentalize. The corpse, which I cut up and understand how it is one thing, but a living being is totally different. They actually separate that, because if they put those two together, they'll probably have to become a monk. But anyway, so here a tadpole, born in water, lived all its life in water, can never understand the nature of water, because it's always been there. They say a fish can never understand what water is. But there comes a time when a tadpole grows legs and arms, becomes a frog. That's the nice part about this simile. Each one of you, you grow your renunciation, your ability to be still, you grow your nimittas and jhanas. And then one day, little tadpole doesn't really know what she's doing, just jumps, just goes into these beautiful nimittas. And she's now standing in a place she's never been to before. For the frog, it's dry land. Totally different than what you've experienced before. So much so that even the other frogs in the lake can describe it to the tadpole, but not really understand what's going on. But now the tadpole frog is standing on dry land. You are in a jhana, nothing like you've experienced before. And afterwards, the frog realized, why was it different? Something which had always been there is now missing. For the frog is water. Now the frog can understand what water is. Only when it's gone away, vanished, disappeared. Just like meditator, once you're in a jhana, you come out afterwards, wow, that was amazing. What was it? Don't ask what it was. Ask what was missing. What had vanished? What had disappeared? The five senses, and together with it, your body. That is the cause of the bliss of the first jhana. Things have vanished, disappeared. Wow, that's so cool. Just like the person who died, their body had vanished. That's why they didn't want to come back again. So, then what? Number one, if you really understand that, you're not really attached to this body. It gets old, it gets sick. You just get tired. Whatever it is, you know, the nature of the body is you get older. Last night, when I went over to like a function for the governor of West Australia retiring, and so that, you know, just chatting around, I got my store of jokes. The one which went down very, very well was the one about the new wine coming from Margaret River. Shouldn't really tell us to Buddhists, because you're not supposed to drink wine, but all these people were into their wine. That's why whenever I go to these functions, I never drink apple juice. Because people take photographs of you. And apple juice just looks exactly the same as whiskey or wine. I always use orange juice, because there's no doubt that that's orange juice. So anyway, I was telling about Margaret River. They got a new type of wine, which is for elderly people, because most of the people go to these functions are all old, like me. It's really hard to see young people in these functions, just old people. But anyway, I told them about the new wine, which was for elderly people. You can drink it in the evening, and you don't need to get up in the middle of the night to urinate. It's based on the very common wines, Pinot Noir and Pinot Blanc. And it's called Pinot Moir. Well, they thought that was very funny. That went down very well. I think I might get invited back. That's what I get up to when I'm not. But anyway, calm down, relax. Oops. More things disappear when you actually just go into deep meditation. And sometimes in that first jhana, you think, wow, you can't get more blissful than that. This is a weird thing. In that first jhana, it's really still. This is beautiful bliss. There's a slight wobble there, but hardly much at all. You know what happens because it's still? It vanishes. Something disappears. And you get into a second jhana. The wonderful art of disappearing. The outermost sheaf, because it still vanishes. That's what stillness leads to. Vanishing. The senses of mind only notice things which change. So what happens next? Get really still. And then afterwards, why is that more blissful? And the reason is that something else has vanished. Something which has always been there for you. Don't always use it, but it's always there for you. And that is your will, your choice, your ability to direct what you want to do next. Will, choice, vanishes in the second jhana. Now, that is just so much more pleasurable. The bliss, your stillness, as the world has vanished. Most people have the understanding your will is part of you, one of the essential ingredients of who you think you are. Your ability to choose, to do, to want. You always assume that's under your control. And all you really need to do in life is to make sure your will is well trained with kindness and wisdom, and then your will no longer cause you any trouble. All your choices in life, all your decisions will be good ones. However, that is pure, unadulterated gomai. The will is the problem. And partly the will is also called sankhara, cause of suffering. What happens? House builder, I know you. I see you. You will not build any more houses in future existence. Sankhara, you are gone. Isn't it wonderful? You accept that? Of course you can't. If you think you did, you are just being conceited. You can't understand that until you actually, the will vanishes, and then you understand what it was. But this is the job of the jhanas, to take you to places which you're just literally seeing things which you cannot see in any other way. You come out afterwards understanding what this will was. When it disappears, so much peace. You see that these days, there's so much choice when you go into supermarkets. There's so much choice. Even, what did I have to get the other day? You're just looking at a printer. No, don't offer one, okay? So a printer, and then there's just so many different types of printers. Can't you just have one? I mean, it's just so difficult these days. You know, airlines, different classes of airlines, cheap airlines, expensive airlines, and just, well, the amount of choice. Even, thank goodness, when I went to Hong Kong, you didn't have any robe shops. You just have one robe. Brown. It would be terrible if there were many more monks and you can get sort of expensive robes or cheap robes or like robes for the cool weather and robes for the wet weather and ones for the hot weather and ones for like meditating monks and ones for city monks and ones for abbots and ones for ex-spiritual directors and ones for... We just have robes, that's all. So you don't have any choice. It's so easy when you get up in the morning as a monk and think, oh, what should I wear today? You just put on your robes, great. So because of that, that choice is a lot of suffering. We think it's, I don't know how you stand it going shopping centres. So much stuff. They come and say, buy me. No, buy me. Buy me. No, me. Buy me. If you want to look like anything in this world, buy me. And it's just crazy stuff. But anyway, that's when the choice vanishes. It's so still, little by little. And that you're just getting into it. More things are going to vanish. Like the white wall. It's not supposed to vanish. That's weird. Little things vanish. Even the piti sukha vanishes. You get real stillness in the fourth jhana. Pure mindfulness. Just knowing. And then, because that doesn't move, that starts to vanish as well. Stage by stage. As what you are watching is still nothing left to watch. You vanish to the immaterial attainment. To nothing, neither perception or non-perception, until the cessation of all perception and experience. Wow. Gone, baby. Gone. That's weird. But that's where this leads to. The art of discipline, vanishing. And I don't need to go on because I've already gone a bit over time. But I am sure, I am certain, without a doubt, There'll be many questions on that this evening. So I'll leave it for then. Sadhu. 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 Okay. Mm-hmm.